Welcome to AFP. My name is Devang Desai, and I'm joined by one usual suspect, David Goss. Nick Andrade is off this week, but on today's show, we chat Canada toppling the U.S. at the Olympics. Greg Berhalter beats Tata again, this time in Las Vegas. Plus, all of your questions on Ask AFP. David, it's true, we're missing Nick this week, but we soldier on. How are you doing, man?
I'm doing great. I haven't slept in probably 8 days, which... surprisingly functioning higher than I thought I would. I love a big event. So I've just, and I never know when the Olympics are live. So I've just been watching them 24 hours a day.
Right.
Yeah. And then you throw a Gold Cup in, you throw a little bit of other action in, MLS action, CPL, USL. So I think I'll probably collapse into a pile of nothing in about a week.
I don't want to complain, and I don't want to sound ungrateful, but frankly, there's too much shit going on at all times. Last week was mental. Like, from beginning to end, the amount of things happening in sports and NHL free agency, NBA draft, MLB trade deadline, Gold Cup, Olympics. Sleeping is not an option. I'd like to see if they've developed cocoons for human beings yet, because I'd like to invest in one for at least 2 months.
We could get you a pod.
Some sort of pod, yes.
As a show.
Exactly, right.
As AFP, I think it would be worthwhile for us to invest in a pod so that when you are at home, we can really like have you suspended, no pressure on you, so that you're at your best when you're ready to host.
I mean, it'll help the show. And the professional athletes are doing it, and I think it's time for me as well. But yeah, it's been a lot. I mean, what a conclusion to the Gold Cup, David. You had an extreme high mixed with a low, but the time zone wise, what a spin. How did you tackle the combination of the Gold Cup final and then Canada USA semifinal?
I enjoyed the Gold Cup final. I actually have to say, this month of U.S. soccer has probably been some of the most enjoyable as like a emotion of watching soccer that I've had in a while.
Wow.
Probably since the Women's World Cup. So what's that? 2 years.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah. So it's been really good. I woke up for the women's game, watched the first segment, and then fell asleep. But I recorded it. So then I woke up and immediately picked up where I left off. I kind of could feel the flow of the game. I watched the Australia game. It kind of felt like that again. I didn't see the result coming, but I saw the flow of the game coming, and it was going to be tough on 2 hours of sleep to probably stay up for that full game straight through.
Yeah, I mean, we had a similar situation on Thursday night with Canada-Mexico and then Canada-Brazil. But by the time you get to that 4 a.m. game, you're gone. And I think the combination of no crowd being there as well. So like you're really watching like a play almost.
Yeah.
And it's, if you're tired, you might go. But I think the beauty of every streaming service known to man somehow having the games available, which is cool, but also like how, like I'm watching the Olympics on Amazon Prime. I'm not asking questions, but it's happening. So everything is on demand and you're able to watch everything at all times. So it's been a lot. I'll be honest, I want to go to sleep soon for a while, but we soldier on, and I want to remind everyone that we are on patreon.com/afootballpodcast, and we'd like to welcome new patron Mike. Welcome, sir. Thanks for joining us. We're very close.
Shout out to Mike.
Shouts to Mike. We're close now to our first goal for patrons. Once we get there, more exclusive interviews that'll be Patreon only. Plus, if you join us there, you'll get access to our post-game episodes coming up featuring World Cup qualifiers. You get access to the Discord as well. Plus, you get the shows ad-free. So it's a pretty good deal. Head on over to patreon.com/afootballpodcast and join today. When we come back, Canada slays the dragon in Kashima.
Fleming against France. Fleming scores! Canada leads in the semi-final. Maybe, just maybe, this is the night for Canada.
A knee slide that will go down in immortality for Canadian soccer. Jesse Fleming, the only goal, Canada's first shot on goal, I believe, up until that point, 74th minute. That's all they needed. For the first time since March 2001, Canada defeats the United States women. A monumental result. You saw it on everyone's faces when the full-time whistle went. you saw Christine Sinclair just being Christine Sinclair and consoling some of her teammates on the Thorns who play for the States. It was an emotional moment, David, and I know you're on the losing side, but I'm curious how it felt for you watching this, because I think as I'll get to you in a bit, it was a pretty significant moment for us in Canada.
So I'd like to start by saying you can have your open of the segment, because I will get mine later on. We will discuss positive things about U.S. soccer. So you're welcome for allowing this setup of the rundown. But I won't say it felt inevitable because of our history playing Canada and the history of this team just being winners. Like you saw coming out of the Sweden game, they just weren't going to lose after something like that. And there's a level of skill and experience with this group that willpower is enough to get them over a lot of humps. But Megan Rapinoe said it after the game. They just never found their form in this tournament. And it wasn't one player. And it wasn't a goal scorer. And it wasn't just one of the center backs. Outside of Alyssa Nair, no one played at their level or above over the course of this tournament. And so it didn't feel like this was a team that was ready to win a gold medal. But at the same time, you go in a semifinal against a team you haven't lost to in 20 years and that you've played a ton. It felt like maybe we had enough to sneak by, and that wasn't the case in this one.
I mentioned the Fleming penalty. The play itself, I mean, at first glance seemed pretty innocuous. I think Deanna Rose taken down, but it looked like maybe just an accidental clash of legs. But of course, we have VAR now, and Katerina Monzul of Ukraine, after consulting with the video screen, decided to come back and said that Tyrina Davidson did in fact foul Deanna Rose in the box, leading to the penalty. I mean, if I was a neutral, these are the kind of penalties that I absolutely kind of hate to see for a game. Yeah. I think it's tough. I don't think there's an intention there to do anything wrong. That being said, there was contact. And I think if you're Davidson, what are you doing? Like, I don't understand why that was done on her part. And thankfully for the Canadians, Fleming stood up and took one of the better penalties you've seen. Did you think that was a pen? I mean, to me, the video speaks for itself. It's just, it sucks to see it kind of go down that way.
Yeah, it's a lot of contact in the box. Would I have called it? Probably not. I actually feel similar. We'll talk about it at the Vancouver penalty. Where is it a penalty or not? I don't know. Would I call it? No. But you create contact in the box. You're opening yourself up to it. And it's to the ref's discretion at that point. And this one was just unnecessary. And it just felt like a moment with where Davidson just wasn't reading the speed of play. And she kind of just throws a leg out there and makes contact. And with I think if there wasn't VAR, there would have been more consideration to make the call on the field. That's my feeling.
Yeah.
But because that exists now as a referee, you're not going to make that bold call you're unsure of, because you know that you have that backup if there really is contact and it should be made. And then you go over and you make the call. But what a take. Talk about a 23-year-old in the semifinal of an Olympics.
Absolutely wild.
And I think Franch was off her line, still wasn't able to save it, and she guessed the right way. It was incredible. And to me, what this whole thing was, is this is a U.S. team that's past its peak in generation. I think most of the players held on too long. There's a level of blame for them. There's probably a larger level of blame for U.S. soccer in handling this whole thing. And then I look at a Canadian side where Jessie Fleming gets her debut at 15 and therefore is ready at the age of 23 for a moment like this. And outside of Christy Sinclair, everyone on the field was in that 23 to 28 age range where they are entering or in their prime. And then you look at 4 games in 9 days or whatever it's been, whatever tight, you know, timeline it's been. And you look at a team that I think is more ready for a tournament like this and more prepared.
I think for this game itself, the injury to Alyssa Nair, probably one of the more significant things. And the fact that Franch came in, Christine Sinclair knows her really well. They're teammates. They practice against each other. And I saw this tweet and I thought it was super interesting, Dave, in terms of who took the penalty and why it was Jessie Fleming. And it's from at Hey It's Liv again. She says, quote, "The most critical thing Christine Sinclair did for her team today was say, 'I'm not taking a PK against the girl I practice taking PKs against because she isn't ruled by ego and she's a great captain.' I wonder if also that penalty against Brazil played into who took that penalty, but I thought it's wild to consider, but you said Jesse Fleming at 23 is a wily veteran in terms of playing on the world stage, and bet it looked like it with that take." I think in that moment where we've seen it possibly in the past for the Canadian women, where they've had a chance to possibly seize it and take this famed next step and not be able to, I think Jesse Fleming scoring there and depositing that penalty was one of the biggest moments ever for soccer in this country. And it's not an overstatement in any regard.
No, and I think you're looking at a legacy for Christy Sinclair, but I think for the national team, you're looking at a group that since 2015, when you host the World Cup and you have a good but maybe not great performance, you've inspired a ton of young players to believe that they can reach this level. And you've created, I think, a larger infrastructure to help players get to this level. And then you look at national team coaches that are willing to give debuts. And I think the debuts, it's not just getting them, you know, acclimated to the international game. I think it has helped players get moves to big clubs in Europe. And so it's sort of worked symbiotic to where you've got a national team where your stars are playing for PSG and Lyon and Chelsea and are ready to then come in and be leaders for this national team. And you're looking at a group where I think similar to the convo we're going to have about the US men's side, like you've got a core for 8 to 10 years now where you can have other star players come in and maybe dominate, but it makes it so much easier for younger players to find their feet, to get debuts, because you've got these other pieces that you can rely on in those big moments. And then the decision from Christy Sinclair is, it's just top class. Like that's a winning mentality to me, is not, I am the best player, I will do everything to win.
100%.
It is an understanding of the entire team and the entire moment.
It says everything you need to know about Christy Sinclair. And I think there's been a lot been said, and the more deserves to be said. And if that even means like her actions after the whistle as well with the American teammate, it's like she gets it. And I think the other awesome aspect of this is I think a generation of Canadians know Christine Sinclair. They know what she's about, but she is introducing a whole new section of players into the national relevance, not through her play alone, but just being that figurehead of this team and where they are now. And they're going to be playing for gold at a watchable time, which I think is the hugest positive development of all this. We can watch the gold medal match at 10 p.m. Eastern, 7 p.m. Pacific on Thursday at a normal time against a Sweden side, David, that hasn't been beaten in 13 games. Those include 11 wins dating back to March 2020. Sweden beat Canada at that World Cup that David was talking about in 2019, 1-0. I think you got to say Canada's the underdog, pretty predominantly the underdog, David, in this final. Do you buy that, or you think it's more even going into it?
No, I think Canada is the clear underdog. That doesn't mean they don't have a chance. That doesn't mean they don't belong on the field. I think it's a way different test than what the U.S. was. This is a Sweden team that's been super aggressive in their press. They've been really aggressive pushing numbers forward, and they can hit you from anywhere. Like one of the things that's so impressive about them is the high-level technical ability across the front line. So they can play quickly into anyone's feet and find a killer pass. It doesn't all have to go through one player, which makes it tough. So I think you're looking at another game where Canada is going to sit deep in their block, but you have the speed to get out on the counter. You have the danger. Sinclair sitting in that number 10 role is able to launch the two forwards into space. So I think it's going to be a similar game plan for Canada, but it's going to be a different game state. And Sweden are the clear favorites. First of all, what's cool about the Olympics is you've already won a silver medal for Canada.
Bam, right? This is gravy, man.
Right.
You got that mantle all ready to go at home with the medal stand.
And I think that sort of changes the way you can think about this. Like, I think for Canada, they're going in with nothing to lose, rather than that level of pressure, which is a huge way to play this game.
And those bronze medal games in the past have been incredibly nervy affairs because of that. Because there is no guarantee of a medal, and Canada pulled it out. But I think this lease on life where it's like, let's go for it. Hell, we might accidentally win a gold medal and no one can take it away from us. Just to close out, Canadian midfielder Quinn will become the first openly transgender athlete to win an Olympic medal after Canada secured their berth in the final. We talk about trailblazers on this team. Shouts to Quinn. Fantastic. So it's not all bad for the United States, David. You're right. I wanted to begin with the Olympics. I wanted to pile it on. I was going to play some Shania Twain. It's good. I'm slamming maple syrup. It's not good for you, but I'm slamming it right now in celebration. But things did go okay for the United States in Las Vegas on Sunday night. It took 117 minutes, but the best player on the field, arguably the best player of the tournament, was the difference. Miles Robinson, a Herculean performance at Allegiant Stadium, which I don't even know what that is or who that is, but it's in Las Vegas, gives Greg Berhalter another huge win over Tata Martino.
Rise. Acosta, header down and in! Robinson, has he won it for the U.S.? With a golden goal!
You've been very honest about this U.S. team coming into the tournament and their expectations and their makeup and what do you want to see out of this tournament. But in the end, you end up with a Gold Cup title and yet another statement win over a battered Mexico side. Things are going pretty well, eh?
Yeah, I think that would be an understatement. That has been it's been a pretty good summer on the men's side for U.S. soccer. The key coming into the summer was, one, win a trophy. And two, prepare yourself depth-wise, understanding of your group, understanding of your best team, understanding of your style and formation for World Cup qualifying. Literally a check next to every one of those boxes, plus some in winning both of these. So in my mind, you won Nations League. That was the trophy. That was it. Now the focus here was, how can you fill out the back end of your roster? How can you prepare for these tight international windows with three games, which we've never seen before? And how can you probably build in spots where you got to worry about injuries? Not everyone will be available all the time, stuff like that. And to show that they could win with this group, to me, shows sort of what I was talking about with the women's side of the culture and the mentality of what Greg Berhalter has built. And it wasn't that case for 4 to 5 years for U.S. soccer. And in these friendlies, the Dave Sarakin years, the early Greg Berhalter years, it felt like players would lie down sometimes. It felt like there was a lack of belief, even when we played some good soccer at times, that we belonged on the field with those teams, that we should win. All of that is gone. For this group to go out and play the way they did, probably better than what the Nations League team played against a strong Mexico squad, and get the win in Gold Cup, it's so big to show where this program is at. And then you've accomplished all those other things of who you're filling in and who's shown that they could play at this level. But like, that win just shows you that now we're looking at a group where there's just this quiet confidence and they're going to be in every game.
To zoom in a bit, and we'll get to MLS a bit later, but Marc-Anthony Kay has been traded to the Colorado Rapids, which was a what moment, but watching this game and seeing maybe not first half Kellen Acosta, but seeing second half Kellen Acosta, I'm like, that partnership is going to be must-see TV going forward for Colorado. I thought he was great, and he's another one of these guys, David, who's not part of the McKinney crew or the Adams crew or the Pulisic crew, but he's part of this crop of players that will be called into service at some point over the next few months that has definitely boosted their resume in Berhalter's eyes.
Yeah, for him, the key was to show he could play as a defensive midfielder, because he doesn't do that with the Colorado Rapids. He's never really done that in his career. That's the need, is a fill-in for Tyler Adams. Greg Berhalter hoped it would be Jackson Ewell. Ewell, it looks like, has played himself off the roster, not even getting off the bench. Gianluca Busio getting into this Mexico game off the bench at 19 before Jackson Ewell kind of shows you where he stands. But Acosta showed that he could be that player. He could be a ball winner. He could shield the back line. He could help build out of the back. Now we finally have a backup for Tyler, which is massive, because I think Tyler's the most important player on our roster, but is an injury-prone player. And then...
do you guys all call him just Tyler? Is he now at the plane of existence where he just goes by Tyler now? Is that it?
One, yes. And two, I've known him since he's 15 years old. I've known him since he had braces on, which means...
I like it. It sounds like a male model from Zurich, Tyler. He's coming to the United States to show his wares.
He's a male model in Leipzig, not that far off, probably. I don't know where Europe is. I've never really looked at a map before. But then Acosta can also play with these other guys, as can Williamson, as can Legette. So you've built out your depth, you've built out your roster, and just the CONCACAF know-how of Acosta over this month, you know, always being a brat before a penalty kick, knowing when to argue against the ref to sort of take pressure off someone who just gave a foul for the U.S. who might be sitting on a potential yellow card, knowing when to rile the other team up, but also not lose yourself in the game. Like, he has really looked comfortable. And you mentioned not part of that generation, although grew up with Weston McKennie in the FC Dallas Academy. The big issue for this group in my mind was with this gap in talent for the U.S., there was no veterans for these young players to ever rely on. And I was worried over the course of this year and a half, is this too much? Landon Donovan and DeMarcus Beasley were 20 when they went to a World Cup, but they played alongside Brian McBride and John O'Brien and Claudio Reyna and Eddie Pope and Tony Sané. Like, they didn't have to carry the team. That's not the case with this group. But now Sebastian Legette and now Kellen Acosta, maybe Matt Turner and Zach Steffen. Now you're starting to get some guys who are in their prime who can make life a little bit easier for these young players.
Before the tournament, I think before a lot of tournaments involving CONCACAF, Mexico was pegged as the favorite. They lost again. Really bad summer for Tata Martino. You hate to see it. You hate to see it. Not really.
Yeah.
And we'll get to Canada a bit later. But David, I wonder, like, this is the Gold Cup. It's not the be-all and end-all, but heading into the fall, the shine is off. I don't know if Mexico is the boogeyman that they were in the past, and that we could all be proven wrong, and maybe they'll stomp Canada in front of an empty Azteca in a few months. But right now, ho-hum, let's play Mexico. No fear.
And I think that's how everyone in the region feels, which for Mexico, that's the biggest issue, is like, you don't have that mental advantage going into games now. You're going to have to work for these wins. You can't rotate your roster out against an El Salvador, against a Jamaica, against a Canada to focus on a Costa Rica or a US, because those teams aren't going to lie down for you. And the biggest thing with this Mexico group is without Raul Jimenez, Tata Martino's teams have had almost no ability to generate and finish chances. When they're generating chances, you look at what Pineda did yesterday, they can't finish. When they are able to finish a couple chances, they're on their back foot and not able to consistently generate chances. So maybe the Premier League season starts. Jimenez is playing for Wolves again. He is who he was, which was probably the best player in the region when he got injured, and none of this matters. But if that's not the case, Tata's entire summer was about showing that they had other options, and they did not do that. So Funes Mori was okay. He's a different type of player. He's a physical presence. He can finish. If you get him chances, he's not going to create anything. Chucky Lozano, obviously with the injury. Now, how long does it take him to get back? Still not his best spot playing as that center forward. So do you use him there? Pulido didn't really get opportunities. Henry Martin scoring goals in the Olympics, which we saw push Uribe Peralta into the center forward spot at the full national team. Maybe that's it. Chicharito. None of these are answers right now. And everything I said with the U.S., check, check, check. For Mexico, it's gone in the opposite direction. They've got less answers, less confidence. And now you're looking at a back line that's starting to give up easy opportunities in big moments, and a front line that can't score enough to make up for it.
In an alternate universe, a different timeline, we had the biggest Canada-USA bonanza of all times, because it would have been USA-Canada in that final after Canada shocked or almost shocked the world in that semifinal on Thursday night. We're going to talk about that Canadian run and what that means for them going forward. Plus, get into some MLS coming up next on AFP. Welcome back to AFP. Canada's Gold Cup journey fell in one of the best games I think we've ever seen the Canadian men play at any level, any time, really. Taking it to Mexico, but ultimately falling 2-1. David, I think this game, I talked about it before, about being what an experience and what a chance to bask in a moment that you can't really simulate. You can't get this environment anywhere else, and it truly did live up to it. It was an extreme road atmosphere for a Canadian team that dealt with the punches as well as you could have hoped they would, and ended up with a huge lifeline thanks to their player of the tournament and Tejan Buchanan. At that moment when he scored, I think I don't ever remember being happier watching a soccer game in some time, because I think a lot of, and was that same feeling this morning watching the women beat the United States? It's like you need to see these things to believe, right? And I don't, in the end, Canada didn't win that game, but when Tejan Buchanan cuts it and deposits that ball in the net, you're like, we got players like that. And it's not just one or two. Leaving this tournament with a loss is tough, but man, it's an incredible run. As an outsider, what verdict do you give this Canada outfit?
Have you ever seen a loss feel more like a win than that game? Like, is that a fair way to say it?
I don't think so. And I think that might be a result of measured expectations and really going into a match with perhaps to a negative degree of like level-headedness. But no, I can't recall a situation like that.
So I think that's where my reaction comes from is, you got a Canada team in this tournament with no Jonathan David, no Atiba Hutchinson, no Alphonso Davies. Okay, fine. Then they play the way they played in the group stage. They outplay the U.S. They're calm against Haiti. They get a dominant win against Martinique. Then you move into the knockouts. And we did the show last week after Costa Rica. That was one of the best performances Canada has ever put in a CONCACAF competition. It was, to me, the first real CONCACAF test for the octagon of the quality of teams, the style of opponent. And this group stepped up to that. Then you lose Cavallini, you lose Vitoria, and then you go in and you outplay Mexico. You push them to the limit. It 100% should have gone to extra time because of the need to stop the game, because fans were chanting things, and then that adds it to stoppage time, which makes no sense. Besides that, though, Canada outplayed Mexico from the goal on and created more chances and was more dangerous. And so I think what I was asking for out of the Costa Rica game was to go toe-to-toe, to show that you have confidence in your program, confidence in your group, and kind of leave nothing out there against Mexico. And that's 100% what this group did. And so now you've got all these players who are key to qualifying with a level of belief and understanding of what they can do in this region. And then you're going to add the cherries on top of the crown jewels of David, Laren, Atiba, and Fonzie. And like, this is a dream scenario for what John Herdman was looking for.
Amazing tournament for the New England Revolution as well. Matt Turner, Tejan showing out. Not too bad. Awesome. And I think John Herdman tweeted this morning about the women's national team and their result and his history with them. It was a cool week for Canadian soccer, and a lot more of that to come in the coming months. But more good news if you're a Canadian soccer fan.
Before we go there, let me ask you this. In abstract, do Tejan and Fonzie both start the next World Cup, the first World Cup qualifier?
On August 2nd, as I speak, I say yes, they do.
Okay.
Is Fonzie available? Is the question.
Don't know.
I wonder what the program is there. But I think what we saw is that, like, not flippantly, but optimistically saying, when Fonzie got hurt, this would be Tejan Buchanan's tournament. It was. Yeah. It actually was. And every single time he's asked the question, he answers it. And I think we speak about him as if he's older than he is, but he's, I think, 23 years old, correct? So I think he is right in the window to make a significant move, just as we've seen many American and Canadian players do. He's only 22, sorry. So I'm aging him inappropriately. He won the Youth Player Award at the Gold Cup. Awesome to see it. And now I'm basking in the transfer rumors, because what seemed impossible a couple weeks ago, it's like, yeah, I could see it. I could see some of these super teams going for our guys. So it's cool.
Yeah.
It's absolutely cool. Vancouver Whitecaps are leaving the wonderful confines of Rio Tinto Stadium. A final 2-2 draw against Minnesota. It's good times, TG, and we don't talk about the Whitecaps that often in terms of good times, to be honest. It has been a tough, real tough go of it, but they're coming home. The Ryan Gold signing is happening, a true number 10, the long-awaited playmaker that they've been desperately craving. Lucas Cavallini should be back from the national team duty. Things are looking up. Adrian Heath super pissed about that penalty at the end to Tahomey, but hey, it's Adrian Heath. Who cares, man? It's the result. Deal with it.
As I said, I think it's a bad play from Finley. That doesn't mean it's a penalty kick. But for Vancouver, this is such a huge week. To be able to go home, they don't have a home game for a while, but they get to be with their families, train at home, get back into a normal schedule, and then you bring Ryan Gauld and you bring Lucas Cavallini as well, who was suspended going into Gold Cup and therefore didn't play so far since leaving for Gold Cup, into the team. This is as big a bump as we have seen Vancouver have, maybe outside of the Thomas Hassall performance and MLS's back last year in the Mark Dos Santos era, and maybe in the last, I don't know, 5-6 years. And so I don't even think it's about making the playoffs or being a cup contender. I just think it's about take that and just be positive for the rest of the season going forward. We've heard the rumors around Cavallini, potentially a European move. Make him want to be here. Make him feel like this was the project that he signed up for. And you look at a team where right now, Dahomey, 8 goals, I think, on the season. Caicedo's playing the best he's played since he got to MLS. Brian White's done a lot of really good work for them in buildup. He's not a finisher. So now Cavallini, can he come back in, do those same things, but add his ability to finish, stretch the line, be creative? And Gauld, what I like about him coming into that midfield three, if it's his 4-3-3, is everything I've seen about him is that he does cover ground and do the work defensively. So you will allow Caicedo and Dahomey to have the freedom to not have to defend that much, but then you bring another level of quality to add into that attack. It's exciting for Vancouver fans, and you should like steer into that. Don't gird yourself right now. Allow yourself to enjoy this, because it's the best moment they've had for a while, and I think there's a lot of promise.
Ryan Gauld, one of 600 players, probably more unfairly hyped by their local media, is the next Messi. I think the Scottish media call him the next Messi. And of course, when you do that, shit goes wrong. But
never fails.
Definitely a promising piece.
Never works out poorly for those players.
Want to doom a kid? Call him Messi. That's the ingredient. In other Canadian news, you know, when you have Inter Miami on your schedule and you have to play in Miami, you're probably going to win. That's how bad Inter Miami has been at home when it didn't matter. I watched most of this game, David, and you might question some of my life choices doing that on a Saturday night in the summer. I know I did at times, but somehow the much maligned Gonzalo Higuain got the winner. They came from 1 goal down. Their first home win this season?
Yeah.
I believe. Yeah. And their first victory in 8 games. Long live Phil Neville. Long live Inter Miami.
I was not prepared for that ending to your comments. So you definitely...
The shocking moment.
Yeah, you definitely threw me for a loop on that one. But for Montreal, I just think you live in Florida. You finally get back home. Then you go on a 3-game road trip at NYCFC, at New England, where they battled in both those games. Those are two of the best teams in the East. They weren't able to win. I think it's okay that you have a letdown against Miami, especially because you stole the points earlier this season against Miami when you went there on the road in the crazy rain game and all that. So I think for Montreal, this isn't like a end of the world moment. You now host Atlanta and then face DC. Those should be points for you. You should get 4 points out of those 2 games. Then I would start to worry if they're not able to get a home win against Atlanta. But I don't know. It's Gonzalo Higuain. He's going to score a goal at some point. And for Miami, they signed Ventura Alvarado this week as well, which should bring a level of stability to the back line. I think Chris Henderson's trying to get papier-mâché over as many of the cracks as he can to not just completely annihilate the culture in Miami. And I just think... It's MLS. This stuff's going to happen. No one's dominating anyone week to week.
I've long said the key to unlocking the potential Inter Miami, one word, Willian. Come on, guys. Come on. All right.
Wait, can I just say on our last show, Kalen Carr mentioned that his Arsenal group chat has gotten very intrigued by Matt Turner. So one for you to look out for.
We tried to ship our backup keeper to Turkey. That deal fell through. We desperately need a number two. Quinn Westberg, Matt Turner, doesn't matter. Start the rumor machine. Finally, the supporter shield, massive turn in that race. It's Seattle lost to San Jose. SKC lost as well to Dallas. But the New England Revolution missing those players we've been talking about. Matt Turner, Tajon Buchanan, doesn't matter. Carlos Heel, was it a pass or a shot, DG to Buxa? I've seen both, but it looked like a pass shot to set up the winner.
So you're
winner.
Just going
to
choose neither, is what you're saying.
I'm going to call it a pass shot. It worked, though. Buxa with one of the better takes we've seen all year. What a comeback. I think you left this game. You turned your head thinking this is an RBNY win,
I did.
Right?
I had to go to work on Saturday night, and I was like hanging on. And it goes 2-1 for Fabio. And I thought the revs had been okay, but not great. And I was like, okay, I feel good about this. And then I get the messages in the Discord that it's a tie. Oh, wow. Okay, but it's the revs. So that's a fine result for New York. And then I get home and see that Buxa won it 3-2 in the 93rd minute, I think was his goal, after Brandon Bye's equalizer. And I went back and watched the game all the way through. And this is a Revs team that, I mean, those goals are such high quality. Like the Gustavo Bo goal is outrageous. And it's not even the moment you go back to on this game. And again, to point out, as you said in the opening segment, the CONCACAF Gold Cup Golden Glove winner has not been there for a month. The CONCACAF Gold Cup Young Player of the Tournament has not been there for a month either. And they have only increased their lead in the Supporters Shield standings. It just shows you how good this roster is.
Don't have this in the notes, but I mentioned the Marc-Anthony Kay trade earlier, DG. Seems like Colorado is kind of going for it, quote unquote, and Robin Fraser's got something developing there that's pretty promising. And that's not a real surprise. I think if you're a TFC fan and know of the work he did in these parts, it's a positive trade, David, I think from the outside. Like, to me, it seems like this is not an all-in move, but it's a significant step forward for a team maybe that was lacking that direction.
I love this move for both teams. I love it for Marc-Anthony Kay. I don't know that all in is what I'd say. I think it's a club who knows, who now has a model, and they're always going to stick to that, right? So if you're Colorado, your model right now is, how can we use assets we don't care about as much, such as Tam and Gam, because they're not going out and signing big-time overseas players, to acquire players in MLS who we think can have bigger roles outside of the club they're at, or fit into our system better than those other teams, or distressed assets. You know, guys who just, they think have quality that aren't getting opportunities. So when a Marc-Anthony Kay becomes available, they're going to move on that, whether it's necessary at this moment or not, because they also have long-term planning, which is Cole Bassett has had a ton of interest from Europe. I think after this Gold Cup, Kellen Acosta is now probably eligible to get a work permit in England for the Championship or the Premier League on top of other European interests. And the reports are that Jack Price has had some interest from the Championship, maybe ready to go back to England. He's been a good soldier for them in midfield. No matter which one of those happens, now they have Marc-Anthony Kay. If none of them happen, Kay, I still think, is an upgrade on all those spots, and especially in a year where you're probably playing two games a week, maybe even in the playoffs. So I love this move for him to get more responsibility, to show that the flashes from him, which are as good as we see in MLS, can be game-to-game dominance. And I think he fits into Robin Fraser's rotations and flow of his game well. And I think for the Rapids, this is just more smart business, more of the same idea, and they've now built an identity.
There you have it. I mean, if you missed some of the MLS action, I do not blame you. And we touch on TFC in the mailbag, but the games are coming fast and heavy. When we come back, we round up this week's episode of AFP, as always, with the mailbag.
Welcome back, everyone. It's now time for everyone's favorite segment, #AskAFP. I'm Nick Andrade, and thanks to everyone who sent their questions this week. If you didn't get the chance to send in your question, just hop on Twitter and use the #AskAFP and send them our way. Does it feel like Nick's here? Did I nail it?
One of the scariest moments I've had on the show, where it felt like a ghost was talking to me.
Was it better than Nick's Marlon Brando or whoever he tried to sing the other day?
His various impressions. It was good. I'll give it a solid 6.5 out of 10. I think there's work to be done, but it's a promising start.
See, I love that, because you never want to start too high, because then there's no room to improve, right?
Exactly.
Boom.
Exactly.
Now I'll probably do the rest of the questions in my own voice. But Devang, let's start with Matt
please
B.
God, dude.
We got awesome questions in the Discord. Also, it's really hard because we get the questions in Discord. I want to immediately answer because I love a lot of them. But then the point is to do it on the show. So I just say things like, I love this question. So that's what I'm doing when I do that. Matt V asks, is Tata still the Mexico coach for World Cup qualifying?
So I will say for the beginning for sure, but the quotes coming out of Las Vegas on Sunday night, troubling, I would say. Mm. I think you're seeing someone double down on the strategy. And I mean, it is true. They had the majority of the possession and you're controlling play, but I think the rigidity and the aspect of we've trained 2.5 years to play this way, we're not going to change it for a single game. It sounds like something that would have been said 20 years ago and we wouldn't bat an eye, but that's just not how it works. And Greg Berhalter is not perfect, but he seems to be pulling some strings. And at least in that sense, it seems to be working. I wonder if the Mexico team or Mexico fans are looking at Tata and asking, where are those from him?
Yeah, I would say 10 years ago, Tata would have been fired before he left the building yesterday. And this is somewhat a compliment to the FMF. They have shown more level-headedness, I think, post Piojo's hitting a reporter and forced to be fired the day after he won Gold Cup, which wasn't their fault, than they did previously with like Sven-Göran Eriksson, Chepo errors. So my answer would have been no. Maybe now. I think from a soccer point of view, the right thing is to keep him. And I think there's enough control and comfort in FMF now in 2021 to allow him to start World Cup qualifying. But he lost twice to the US in finals in one summer, including a tournament in which Tata Martino, in a press conference before the tournament started, said he thought it was disrespectful that the US brought a B team, which he then lost to. So there's no excuse that the US was a good side or a better side or anything like that because of your own words. It's going to be a fascinating 6 weeks leading into qualifying, but I think that short turnaround is probably what keeps his job.
Life comes at you fast.
Jason G asks, what is your take on Perez's approach to substitutions with TFC?
So Javi Perez still unbeaten, but with Draw City in TFC land, and you don't make friends with draws, much like you don't make friends with salad. And I think questions are being asked of some late game management. Josie came out late against Nashville, which I don't think is a shock, but you've had instances where Patrick Mullins has come in for Soteldo in tie games where fans are like, what's going on here? I don't think there's that much to read into this other than there are fitness issues across the board for some of these players. And I think Javi Perez is as much managing these guys to see it that they can play in a few weeks as he is to get wins right now, which I think might be underselling how critical the time factor is here for TFC in terms of what they want to get out of the season. That's my only explanation, that this is about protection for the players.
I agree with you. You just, as much as you want to make the playoffs, you can't lose Soteldo to a long-term injury. You can't risk Josie and Bradley in that way. And so I think that's the basis of the moves and the number of games that are being played. I do think with Osorio coming back now from national team duty, that's just like a chunk of minutes that
huge
because he can. Yeah. I mean, when he's healthy, right, he'll go 90 game after game in four different positions at a high level. So now you've pulled those 90 minutes in. It's going to become easier now to distribute the Pasuelo, Soteldo, Michael minutes across that because you've got Oso and Delgado who can just go forever. But I think for Javi Perez, there's, you know, and you're getting it from sports science and the data analytics team of this is where these players are at. You can't risk them. I don't even know that he has an option with a lot of these. Dan H says, does a third place game make sense in a tournament like the Gold Cup since there are so few meaningful games between the big teams in CONCACAF? I know people hate on third place games and I get where they're coming from, but this seems like a situation where it makes a lot of sense.
I was relishing the chance to play Qatar in a third place game and was livid when I saw that was not a possibility. I get where Dan's coming from here. And it's like, yeah, let's give us, we got a taste of that Mexico game. It's like, give us more. But I wonder the stakes of it, completely suck the importance out of anything I gained out of it, I wonder. Because any third place game I've seen is a painful encounter where the teams barely want to be there. It's a exhibition of trying to avoid injury while running around. It never has a good vibe. And although I like games and I like seeing the national team play more, I don't think the third place game is worth anything.
I agree with you. And I would say the only thing you need to know is I was unaware whether there was or was not a third place game at this Gold Cup.
Exactly.
That shows the value. The one thing I would throw in is because the Gold Cup's every 2 years, that to me takes away the need for that because I understand you don't have a ton of high level games, but you have you have an extra tournament in the cycle. So rather than push guys and risk them in a third place game, you just have a whole second tournament where they get to play against each other. So that really changes it for me rather than a World Cup where it's once every 4 years. Final question here, and it's from the man himself. Question.
See, you should have done this in his voice. You should have done this one in his voice.
I still can. Do we know where does Nick live in Toronto? What neighborhood? Do you know that?
I think that's classified, to be honest.
Well, I was going to say Nick Andrade that. From so-and-so, but okay, fine, Devang. You've already shut me down. Question here from Nick. Jonathan David's been linked with a move to Liverpool as Lille are in financial trouble. Is that a good move for JD? That was way better than the open. That was spot on for me.
That's observing a master at his craft get better from one performance to another, and you have to tip your cap. Nick sent this to us in the group chat, and my first reaction was, no, I don't like it necessarily for where it is for JD. It's not me being a Liverpool hater. I wonder if Liverpool is a good place for Jonathan David at this current moment. I think he's good enough, but Liverpool to me is. I wonder if like their plans fit in with relying on someone like Jonathan David to like find himself quickly, or like what do they want out of him? Is he a project? Is he a development player? He doesn't get a lot of run. Like my fear is that he goes somewhere and doesn't get to play a lot. And Liverpool is one of those places where I worry about minutes.
So I think that's fair. I think it's okay if he were to leave this year to have a year to develop somewhere and get your feet wet before having to be the starter, which is what it would be at Liverpool. My big worry would be Diego Jota. Like, is he the guy at that center forward position? I think Jonathan David could play any of those three spots in that team. I think he would be a really good fit for Klopp's system. But I worry that he would be behind Jota. I guess that's my main reaction. And if that's the case, I've said Dortmund before for him, although it sounds like maybe they've already done their work in replacing Haaland. I think there are other clubs where he could fit in, but I don't think it's ridiculous to say that if he was told you are the heir apparent to Roberto Firmino, who's 29 or 30, hasn't maybe played at his highest level the last year and a half for them. Like, I think that's not a bad spot for David to come into. I guess the problem would be, does he end up in a situation like Minamito where you don't play, you go out on loan, and then your reality becomes a bit murky.
Murky realities. I think Granit Xhaka and Moal Nani will start Arsenal's first game of the season. This is the darkest timeline. Also quickly, Theo Corbanu to Sheffield Wednesday loan from Wolves. Sheffield Wednesday, who is in the third tier. A bit surprising, David. I think Wolves fans that I've seen saying they thought he was relatively close to first team minutes potentially, but I wonder if that timeline's thrown off with the new coach in charge. But he's going on the third tier. He'll play a load. That's the positive. But I wonder how you view this.
I thought he was good enough to play in a first division outside of England or in the second division. Like, I just feel like from the performances I see with Canada, he's already above a League One level. And so that's the only thing that's unfortunate. I'm fine with him going out on loan. I'd love to see him get a chunk of minutes for the first time in his professional career. I'd love to see the flashes become, this is what he can do week to week. I think Holland, Belgium, that's where I thought it would happen, or the championship. So I think that's the only part about that that's frustrating. I'm fine with him going out on loan at this point, though.
I think that's it. I'm going to have to go do an exorcism to forget that voice of Nick from David. That was one of the more haunting things I've heard. But Nick will be back next week, a reminder before we go, a rating or a review, wherever you get this podcast, would be wonderful for us. We're on Twitter at a football pod and also on patreon.com/afootballpodcast. Exclusive episodes, get the show ad free, Discord access, early access. It's a good deal. It helps us out as well to create the show. So head on over to patreon.com/afootballpodcast. And that's it for Dylan, for David, and for myself. Thank you so much for listening to AFP. We'll talk to you next week.